Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690. It's a Wednesday, and that means it's time for our chat with the fine folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Javen Strongs and James Coover. How you doing?
Good morning. Doing well,
hey,
thank you.
Good to have y'all. Get a little bit of rain out of your place?
Yeah, we got about 3 tenths.
Okay. Yeah. Good deal.
Point six, not too bad.
We only got a tenth of an inch here. So.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's farther north, it's wide and widely varied, but even Wichita was kind of divided in half. So, hey, we'll take whatever we can possibly get.
Exactly.
So, good deal. Well, David, as your diversified ag agent, we're going to talk a little bit about goats today, and specifically a few points that people want to know and go over if they're looking for signs that they need to deworm.
Yes, so this time of year is when parasites really start to take off in pastures because they like the warmer weather and the rain. So they like more moisture to really be able to thrive along with that warm weather. And while we have been drier since last year, it's still important to be on the lookout for them, because especially in pasture situations and with a dry year not having as much grass, those pastures probably got grazed down a little bit more. So then goats and all types of animals, as they're grazing this spring, they might be eating closer to the ground, closer to the base of that grass, which is where parasites really live. So now's the time to start looking at your goat herd and determining which ones that need to be dewormed, treated for parasites. And this is something that I like to try to do about once a month during this time of year, just to stay on top of it, try to keep any animal from really going downhill from an overabundance of parasites. So like you mentioned, kind of what to check for. So for goats and sheep, recently, or I guess in the last couple of years, parasites have started to become resistant to common dewormers that are used, which especially for sheep and goats, there's a limited number of dewormers that are labeled for them. So this is really a concern. So to kind of try to stop the resistance from spreading as quickly in the worms, now it's recommended that instead of just, you know, working everybody, deworming all of them, you go through and only deworm the ones that are showing signs of internal parasites, and to help determine which ones need to be wormed, which ones are showing those signs, they've developed what's known as the 5-point check. So it's looking at 5 different areas of a goat to help determine, make that decision if they need to be dewormed or not. So the first one is the eyes. So this one, for folks that have raised sheep and goats a while, they may be familiar with Fomantra scoring, which is looking at the color of the inner eyelid. And that is on a scale of 1 to 4. So 1's great. It's a nice cherry red color, which unfortunately you hardly see. and then a 4 is a sheet white. It's very white and pale. So you want to look for that nice pink color. If you start to see a light pink, that's usually a sign that they need to be dewormed. And this is an indicator mainly of barber pole worms. They're a blood sucking parasite. But usually, you know, if they have one type of worm, they have others. So that's the first thing you look for. Next, you look under their jaw. So if they develop bottle jaw, which is another sign of barber pole worms, they're a really troublesome parasite for sheep and goats. The bottom of their jaw will start filling with fluid, and it will start to look swollen. So, of course, that's another sign that they need to be treated, specifically for barber pole worms in that case. And then another sign, of course, of parasites is the loss of weight, because they're taking nutrients away from that animal. So you look at their back between their ribs and their hips, And that really is body conditions, scoring them, seeing how much fat cover they have over the top of their back. And if they're skinny, if it's super easy to feel their backbone and kind of feel the individual vertebrae, then that's another sign that they need to be dewormed, especially if they're, you know, being fed adequate feed for their production stage, whether that's growing if it's a kid, or nursing kids if it's an adult doe. And then another thing to look for is their hair coat. So if it's coarse, and that can be a sign of parasites, especially if a coarse coat is combined with maybe their eyes look, you know, not super pale, but just a little on the lighter pink side, or their body condition's a little lower. If you kind of combine those different signs and they're all, you know, just not quite right, then that would be one that you would probably want to deworm. And then the fifth place to look for is their tail, so signs of diarrhea or scours, because especially on kids, that's a sign that they have internal parasites as well.
Sure. So if anyone, the producer, sees any of these signs, what's the next step they need to be taking?
So the next step would be to deworm that animal, treat them for the internal parasites. So there are a few dewormers that are labeled for sheep and goats, or they can work with a veterinarian and use, for example, use a cattle dewormer off-label for goats is another common practice. But because it's off-label, you do need to have that relationship with a veterinarian. So you would want to deworm the goat. And it's important when you're deworming them to make sure you're using a dewormer that's labeled for the type of parasite you're dealing with. So of course, for a lot of parasites, you don't know exactly which one you're dealing with unless you take a fecal sample and look at it to determine what parasites are in the fecal matter. But if it's a high Fomantra score, so it's like almost a white color on the inner eyelids, or they have bottle jaw, those are two signs of barber pole worms. So then you would want to make sure you get a dewormer that's listed as treating barber pole worms. And then the other important part is when you're deworming, to use the correct dosage. That's another part that's led to parasites becoming resistant, is incorrect dosage. And for goats, it's actually usually not using a high enough dosage, so then parasites get you know, just a little bit, and they can start building that resistance. So if you have a scale, that's you know, that's really great, because then you can weigh the animal and the dosage is based on weight. I know a lot of times you don't have a scale right there when you're working goats, so you can estimate their weight, and you can kind of go with a best the best estimate you can make. So definitely do that. Don't just use the same amount for every goat in your herd, because there's always bigger ones and smaller ones.
Now, if you find some of these signs in one goat, is there some likelihood that you're going to find it in others too? Do you want to go ahead and just treat the affected animals, or do some people like to treat everyone, or how does that work?
So some people still like to treat everyone, yeah. But it's really recommended now to help prevent parasites to continue to become resistant to dewormers, to only treat the animals that are showing signs. Okay. And then that can be another so herd management practice. So some breeders, they, like, one of their goals for their herd is to get animals that are more tolerant of parasites. So then they'll actually, you know, look at their records and see what animals need to be treated for parasites the most. And then they'll make the decision to cull those animals. So it can be another herd management practice to decide who you want to keep and who you want to cull.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. Well, anything else on this, and any way to reach you if people, you know, do have questions and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, so if they have any questions, they can reach me by calling 620-331-2690.
Okay. Well, David, very good. I appreciate that information. And James, what are you going to talk about here in the next segment?
So we're planting soybeans out there. At least we were before the rain. And so I'm actually going to talk a little bit about soybean nodulation and a little about the science of how soybeans create their own nitrogen through the symbiotic relationship with the bacteria.
Excellent.
And so, I don't know, just timely, I guess.
Very good. Nodulation. That's a good word here on a Wednesday morning. All right, well, we'll have that coming up here in just a few moments here on the Mighty 690. We have 62 degrees heading back into the 80s here this afternoon. Good morning, 8:11 here on the Mighty 690 as we continue throughout a Wednesday morning. Continuing our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, we have David and James joining us once again. Good morning again. And James, we have an event coming up.
That's right. We got Spring Crop Field Day coming up. And so this is, you know, one of our big events. It happens at the Southeast Center every year. And it's really, it's a showcase of what the Southeast Center is up to. It's always a really good time. We spend a lot of the time outside, actually, touring the fields and looking at stuff. It's really popular. Most years we have over 100 people there. So it's a big event. We'll do the wheat tours as we normally do. We'll talk about fungicides because that's the time of year. Planting technologies and growing profitable crops. There'll be a big technology part to this year as well. And so, you know, it's a really good time. I really suggest people come. It's going to be on Tuesday, May 23rd. We'll start it off at 8:30 registration. We'll begin touring the fields about 9 o'clock. So, you know, nobody wants to miss it. And, of course, we feed you lunch, too.
Hey.
So that's my part.
It's always good.
So if you're interested in coming to the Spring Crop Field Day, just give us a call or give the Southeast Center a call, too, and just let us know that you're coming.
Great. Good deal. Well, good to have that on the calendar coming up here a couple weeks on a Tuesday. And so before we here get into our topic here, I did want to ask you before I forgot, how are the different crops looking here in Southeast Kansas?
They're
right
looking
now?
Pretty good in comparison. I mean, honestly, we've gotten some timely rain, at least in the last 2 weeks, maybe not before that.
Yep.
But it's not like our soil profile's charged or anything. It's not like we have any excess water at this point. But for the most part, it's kind of spoon-feeding us along, and we've got a pretty good wheat crop. And so in comparison to most of the state, our wheat's looking pretty good. Usually it's drowned out by now, but this year it's right on the money. And which is good because the wheat market is kind of up right now, too. So
hey, there
yeah.
you go.
Yeah, I mean, at least we'll get that. You know, we haven't had a good crop of anything in a while. So it's a good news for farmers.
Good to get a win here. So today we want to talk a little bit about the factors that affect soybean inoculation.
That's right. So a lot of farmers are putting in their soybeans. A lot of them tried to get in before the last rain and as all the air drills out there. And those have to be full of soybeans. I'm not sure what else you do with those. So, I mean, this time of year. So, I want to talk about inoculation. And by this, I mean the symbiotic relationship between the soybean and the rhizobium on the soybean roots. And so, this very odd kind of special relationship, you know, the bacteria infest the roots and forms a little nodule. And that nodule actually turns atmospheric nitrogen into nitrates. It's the enzymes of nitrates. And so the plant feeds the bacteria sugar. And so those two things are moving back and forth. It's a symbiotic thing. And turning atmospheric nitrogen into any other kind of nitrogen is very difficult. I mean, it takes a lot of energy. It's kind of cool that bacteria can do that, honestly. So this happens in any legume crop. Basically, for you gardeners out there, garden beans, they do the same thing. I mean, really any of the things. Peanuts are another legume that actually converts this stuff. So we don't put nitrogen on any of these crops because we don't need to. You can actually buy little packets of inoculant for your garden green beans, and you can stir the two together. Most of the time when you buy garden green beans, they don't have the inoculum on the seed. So you have to buy that separately in a little tiny packet and mix those two together. So farmers do the same thing, but on a much bigger scale. I mean, they actually buy bags of inoculate and mix it up with their green beans if they don't come already inoculated.
Okay.
Usually they come already inoculated. However, the rhizobia, it can survive in the soil from year to year, or even, you know, in the gap year. So you do corn, soybeans, it can survive from the off year as well. And it'll survive in the soil, and then when you plant the soybeans, it'll find the roots and, you know, take them on and all that. Still, it's a good idea to inoculate every single year because you don't want to risk not having that. However, because rhizobium are bacteria, pretty much anything that has a bad conditions for bacteria in the soil is also bad for rhizobium as well.
So. Okay, yeah, for sure. Now, you can have like the poor soil conditions that we've been talking a little bit about. What sort of things are we talking about with like some poor soil conditions?
So I would say the soil being too acidic is the number one. Pretty much anything below 6 is going to be hard for bacteria to do their processes in. I mean, especially in this area, honestly, because of our soils, you know, are naturally acidic and our subsoil is acidic. So it's even more important for this area. And so too low, it causes toxicity of metals. It causes poor absorption of nutrients, and bacteria have a harder time surviving because they have to do all those processes that plants do as well. And they have a much harder time because they have nowhere. I mean, it's a very small microclimate that they're living in. So anything adverse is going to affect them to a greater degree. And another thing is soil nitrates that are actually too high. This is kind of odd because if the plant doesn't need the microbes, they won't take them on. And so the plants are actually like use the microbes as a farm. And so they're farming these microbes and feeding them and getting something out of it. But if they don't need it, then they won't take them on. And then later on, when those nitrates run out, they won't be there to feed the plant. So you'll end up with yellowing later on, nitrogen deficiency, if you have too much nitrogen in the beginning. Low phosphorus is a pretty big one because the plant really won't be able to support those microbes as well. Phosphorus is a very common thing, a nutrient that causes poor nodulation. Also, the bacteria, they need phosphorus too, with a lot of their enzymes and compounds. So that's pretty important. Now, the two that are a little bit different than the others is actually low molybdenum and low boron. Those two are actually enzymes that we need in our soil that's involved in that process. And so the thing that the microbes use to convert the atmospheric nitrogen into nitrogen enzymes requires molybdenum. It's a molybdenum nitrous compound. And so, you know, without that, they can't do their process. They can't do their weird thing that they do. The boron, however, it's often necessary. It's actually deficient in our soils here in Southeast Kansas. We have a naturally low boron level in our soils. It is hard to show, though, with fertilizing boron in soybeans to actually end up with any amount of yield response. But all the physics is there, and all the equation. We should be actually putting boron fertilizer on our soybeans, but for some reason, it doesn't really respond to yields very well, at least in the research trials we've done. I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done in that area, personally. So, environmental stresses, they can also cause poor nodulation, drought, waterlogging, you know, soil temperatures. There's been lots of situations where after a rain, it gets really hot, you'll end up steaming the roots of the soybeans.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And you can smell it.
That's wild.
It's odd. And so it steams the roots and it kills those little microbes down there, and it almost turns them into silage. It's kind of an odd situation, but it has a lot to do with like timing and ground cover, because if you cover the ground, it's not going to steam the ground as much. So it's just a situation that kind of happens with soybeans, especially in about a month. That's when all that stuff really starts to happen.
Interesting. So, well, so what's going to happen to the soybeans if these bacteria die?
So they fairly quickly become yellow, become chlorotic is what we call it, and that's from nitrogen deficiency. So it's a complete lack of nitrogen in our soybeans. There are other things that look a little bit like nitrogen. It's not necessarily that has to absolutely be it. Lack of sulfur and some other things look similar. You can technically fertilize soybeans with nitrogen. However, you won't see any increase in yield response. So you can either fertilize with nitrogen or you can get those microbes. It's not like fertilizing, you're going to end up with more yield. But that takes like 150 to 200 pounds of nitrogen to the acre. It's more than corn. It takes a lot of nitrogen to feed soybeans because it's a huge part of that high protein that they create. So
what do these nodules actually look like?
It's kind of, they look like an infection. I guess really they are an infection, really. That's weird. So they look like an insect gall that lives on the roots of the soybeans. And so, or, you know, if you're a gardener, they look like little on your green beans as well. They'll live on the roots, and they'll be little, these little tiny balls, really. I mean, BB size really is... the healthy ones will be pink inside. And so you can pull up a soybean plant carefully. You got to actually dig them up and wash them off, and because you can actually pull the galls off as you're pulling those up. And the healthy ones will be pink inside. It's actually pink from it's leguminous hemoglobin. So just like we have hemoglobin, these little microbes are doing the same
thing.
Because they have to live in an antibiotic or a non-oxygen environment to do their processes.
Okay.
So that leg hemoglobin is pink, and that's the color it'll be. If they're dead, they'll be gray and mushy inside. And so they've let all the oxygen in, and now they turn gray and doesn't look good. To check your soybeans for those little long nodules, wait till V2 or V3. They got to take a little time for them to pick up and get going. A few trifoliate leaves, but always check the main stem for these nodules. The ones on the outside in the farther roots, those might or might not be still alive, but the ones in the main root are always going to be good. So just make sure that when you're checking, though, don't just rip them out, because you'll end up ripping all those galls off and you think, well, there's not there. That's an issue. Actually, just you messed up and you pulled them out and they're in the soil right now. So for the most part, I mean, it's a pretty cool relationship, and I don't know, I'm kind of fascinated by soil microbes and all that.
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, it's pretty amazing some of the symbiotic relationships we see in nature, and this is just another really cool example of something that, yeah, you know, the layman would never really even think that something like, yeah, you just plant a seed in the ground and it grows. But even for gardeners, there's a lot more going on underneath the soil than we expect.
Yeah, and it's a lot of nitrogen we're talking about. I mean, if we had to fertilize our soybeans the same that we fertilize our corn, it would be a lot more nitrogen.
Yeah, it would not even be feasible in some regards.
So. Exactly.
Very good. Well, James, anything else you'd like to add? And a reminder here on the Spring Crop Field Day. So again, sign up for that.
That's right. So Spring Crop Field Day, May 23rd. We'll start from 8:30. And, you know, please give us a call if you're interested in coming to that. It's always a big event. And so people really want to hear what the Southeast Center is up to and hearing about all the research. So.
Excellent. And if people have any crop questions for you, they need to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Give me a call. The number for Gerard is 620-724-8233.
All right. And David, if people have any questions for you, how can we get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can give me a call at the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
Okay, well, it's been always a pleasure to talk, as always. Appreciate all the knowledge and good resources you guys are. And look forward to chatting again here real soon.
Thanks for having us.
All right, David and James, as we wrap up here with our segment from K-State Research and Extension. And we'll have Open Line on the way next here on the Mighty 690.